build big Hamiltonians and diagonalize them. But I want to give it a physics touch. So the physics today will be to study the low energy spectrum of our critical spin chain and relate whatever we observe at low energies to quantum criticality. Okay? And I'll start with 10-minute theoretical discussion of what that means. So remember our Hamiltonian, it's the Ising Hamiltonian. We've parametrized it as cosine theta, some hxx, sine theta, hz, where the first term contains nearest neighbor couplings in the form of sigma x between nearest neighbor. And the second term is a magnetic field or single site sigma z. Okay? And the claim is that if we choose theta to be pi over 4, so if we choose this coefficient to be equal to this coefficient, then we get a critical point. Now, what does it mean to have a critical point? This will be a quantum critical point. What that means is that at this particular value, if our spin chain was very large, large enough, we would see that when we change the angle, okay, when we change this angle, when we change the relative importance of these two terms, when we hit this particular angle, there will be a phase transition. The properties of the ground state of this Hamiltonian will change, not smoothly, but there will be an abrupt change. Okay? So this happens at zero temperature, so it's quantum, meaning it doesn't it's not a thermal phase transition. It's a quantum phase transition. It occurs at zero temperature. Okay? It's not due to thermal fluctuations, it's due to quantum fluctuations. These are the typical words that come with this. I'm happy to discuss them later if you are interested. Now, for us, what's important here is that when we hit this particular value, when we choose theta to be the critical one, we'll have that our critical spin chain, right? So these are the spins. They are on circle, given that we have periodic boundary conditions in the Hamiltonian. It turns out that when we look at the low energy properties of this critical spin chain, so if we look at the ground state versus excited state, you know, low energy states, they actually behave in a way that we'll specify later. They behave in a very similar way as if we had a quantum field theory, a specific type of quantum field theory called conformal field theory. Okay? And I don't intend to explain to you what's a conformal field theory, what's a quantum field theory. I'm just giving you some data. Some of you know what this is about and can make good use of it. Otherwise, I'll just tell you what this implies and we'll search for that type of relation numerically. But the idea is that a conformal field theory is a theory in the continuum. So here we had only degrees of freedom on the sides, right? Our spins were here, here, here. In the field theory, you have that the degrees of freedom are every single point of the real line, or in this case of the circle, you have some oscillator or something. Okay? So it's a theory in the continuum. Okay? And then I'll say a couple more things about a field theory, which is a conformal field theory. An important aspect of it is that there is some operator state correspondence. That means that if we have a Hamiltonian for the quantum field theory, for the CFT, on the circle, and we look at the low energy states, so let's this be low energy states for alpha equal to 1, 2, okay? This will be eigenstates of the Hamiltonian on the circle. And let's denote E alpha CFT, the corresponding energy. And momentum. Let me call it K alpha. Okay. So one of the things that we have in a CFT is that if we diagonalize the Hamiltonian in the continuum and the momentum operator in the continuum, these two guys commute, and that means we can simultaneously diagonalize them. And this is a continuous version of what we did the other day. Remember, we had the Hamiltonian and the translation operator that was shifting the sides by one, but T was shift by one side. Remember that? Okay, and we had that the two operators commuted, and therefore we could simultaneously diagonalize both of them. So there is a continuous version of this. Okay. If you want, you can think of T as being exponential of I P. Okay, the continuum. The idea is that here we can only make discrete translations. Here we can do continuous translations, and that will be P will be the generator of this continuous translation. In any case, the idea is that in a conformal field theory, we can simultaneously diagonalize the Hamiltonian and the momentum, and we can write the corresponding energies and momenta as in some fancy way. I'm just going to write it, and we are not going to get too worried about some details. I'll just focus on a couple of them. Okay, so we know what the energies, possible energies of excited states on the circle are. They're given by 2 pi over n, n here. Here was the number of spins, right? N number of spins on the spin chain. In the continuum, n is the length of the circle. So what we have is that all the energies are proportional to 1 over n. That means that when we make the circle very large, the energies all collapse, right? For large n, all these energies are going to collapse. And this theory, if we had a very large circle, will become gapless. There is no energy gap between the ground state and the first excited state. The gap is 1 over n, n goes to infinite. There is no gap. In any case, what's important about this is that these quantities, okay, this is called scaling dimension, delta alpha scaling dimension. S alpha is some conformal spin. Okay, and this is called the central charge. These are quantities that, one, we know them, we can compute them in some way using conformal field theory. And second, they characterize the universal properties of the phase transition. So remember that when we are at the critical point, if you look at low energy properties, they are universal. They don't depend on the microscopic realization of your model, right? So I don't know, so a magnet or water behave in a similar way when you get close to a phase transition. So the idea is that this data here, which is known as conformal data, the conformal data is precisely all these universal pieces of information. Okay? They take specific values, and maybe we start with a critical spin chain that is the Ising model, or maybe there is another critical spin chain which is microscopically different. The degrees of freedom, maybe instead of up and down, you could have up, down, and some other option. Okay, but at the critical point, if they are in the same universality class or the same type of quantum phase transition, they will be described by the same scaling dimensions and conformal states. Okay? So our goal today is actually to compute these guys, starting from the spin chain. And what's happening here is that, just to complete this rushed explanation, is that the operator state correspondence of a CFT says that the low energy states on the circle are in one-to-one correspondence with the scaling operators of the theory. And these quantities, the scaling dimensions and conformal spins, are properties of these operators. But you know, this is for those who know something about CFTs. Okay? Otherwise, don't worry about it. The point is that what we are trying to do today is to compute universal properties, okay, from the spin chain. So our goal is to actually compute these guys. Any questions until now?
How to compute the numbers?
How to compute those numbers?
The quantities, scaling the machine and the conformal spin. You have any formula to compute?
Right. I will give you a formula now, and that's probably all we need to keep with us from this explanation. Before I give the formula, was there any other question? Okay, so formula. Okay. So the idea is that on the lattice, we'll have our Hamiltonian translation operator. They commute, we can simultaneously diagonalize them. So let's say that this is a simultaneous eigenvector of H and T. Okay? What that means is that H times this is equal to some energy times the same vector, and T this is e to the I k alpha phi alpha. Okay? Now, this is an e from energy, and this is exponential. Okay? Let's not get confused. Okay, let's look at this. So, question is whether there is any relation between these quantities that we can compute on the lattice and these energies that would come from the CFT. And the answer is yes, they are closely related, and here is the formula. So, E alpha on the lattice is equal to some non-universal constant that we don't know, plus another universal constant that we don't know, divided by 2 pi m delta alpha minus c over 12. So now I'm just recovering this part. Plus higher order corrections that go as 1 over n, 1 plus gamma. Let me write the second expression, and then we look at them for a minute. Okay. So here it is. These are the two expressions. Now, you recognize that this is numerical data that will come from diagonalizing the Hamiltonian and the translation operator simultaneously. And on the other hand, this, okay, this is universal CFT data. Okay? So the idea is that we will compute these guys, okay, numerically, and from there we will extract these universal properties. So that's the formula. And let me read this for you. So the problem we have is that the lattice data, the energies and momenta that we will extract by diagonalizing the Hamiltonian and the translation operator, they are not just what we want. They come with some constant A that we don't know, some constant B that we don't know, and some corrections. See, if we look at the system size, there is a constant. This part is independent of the system size. The part that we're interested in comes with 1 over n. So the larger the system, the smaller this part is going to be. But on top of that, there are corrections that are higher order in 1 over n. Okay, so I didn't say what gamma is, but typically gamma, we expect gamma to be larger than 0. So this becomes smaller faster than this term. And so our interest will be in considering large spin chains such that this term is not important compared to this one. Okay? Very good. So this is all the theory I wanted to discuss. Maybe this sounds a bit abstract, but let me tell you, for instance, that from the scaling dimensions, we can compute all the critical exponents. Okay, so maybe critical exponent is something that sounds more familiar. So if you have a phase transition, people will ask you, what are the critical exponents? And I'm not going to give you more expressions, but the idea is that if you know the scaling dimensions, you can compute the critical exponent. All right? So we pretended long enough that we care about physics, we can forget about that. Just keep this expression. And now the question for you, for today, is how do we compute? Specifically, we'll focus on scaling dimensions and conformals. Okay? That's the goal for today. All right? Very good. So, there is one more thing actually I have to tell you that will be important in order to, we'll figure out how to compute this and in order to extract these guys, ignoring A and B. What we are going to use is additional information. And the additional information is that is the following. So of course, in this particular case, it's the critical Ising model. There is a CFT, a conformal field theory called Ising CFT. So probably there is a reason why the CFT is called Ising. So we actually know what's the CFT. Okay? And we're just going to check that indeed we get the right answer. But in general, we would not know what the right answer is. Right? So you know, we're working with the Ising model, but you can go change the function that creates the critical Hamiltonian, change it a little bit. It can be a new theory that you don't know the answer. And so the same code would work in that case. So what we need is some information that is true for any CFT. We want to get rid of A and B by using information that is true regardless of what the phase transition is. And the information is the following. In every CFT, okay, there are two states, two low energy states that are always there and have the following properties. One, there is the ground state of the Hamiltonian CFT. We can denote it by identity ket. And it has the following. It has the scaling dimension of the identity and the conformal spin of the identity is equal to 0, 0. Okay? So, and this will correspond to the ground state of the spin chain. I'll tell you in a second how to use that. The second statement is that there is another state always that we're going to call stress tensor state. Another eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. We're going to denote it by T. And this guy is such that the scaling dimension of its scaling dimension and conformal spin is always 2 and 2. Okay? So thanks to this, thanks to knowing that, we actually also know that this will be the lowest energy, this will be the lowest energy state, the ground state, and this will be the lowest energy state, the lowest energy with spin 2. Okay? So these are, this will help us get rid of A and B. Okay? We're going to use this information. And to make it even easier for you, I'm just going to tell you how we're going to exploit this. I'm going to do it just here. So let's look at the energy for any state E alpha minus the energy for the ground state. Okay? Clearly A will disappear from the subtraction. So that's gonna look like B 2 pi over N scaling dimensions plus higher order corrections. Right? I should write minus the scaling dimension of this guy, but it's 0. So we don't need to worry about that. So what I'm saying is that if we take the energies that we compute from the lattice, right, the ground, the lowest energy, and some other energy, if we subtract them, we'll get that they relate to the scaling dimension through an expression that no longer contains A. Right? We just subtracted two guys that were all of each of which had A, so A is gone. Okay? Now, let's do the same for the stress tensor, so ET minus E identity. the energy for the stress tensor state minus the energy for the ground state. And what do we get? The same expression, but now we put a 2 here because that's the scaling dimension for the stress tensor. Okay. And the last thing we want to do is to take the ratio of this. If we take the ratio of these expressions, what we get is E alpha minus E identity divided by ET minus E identity is equal to, and then take the ratio, and usually gives, should give delta alpha divided by 2. Okay? So the idea is that if you want a given scaling dimension, you just take the ratio of differences of energies multiplied by 2, and you get it. Okay? I mean, there are plus subleading corrections, and the idea is to try to consider sufficiently large systems that these corrections will not be too important. So the scaling dimension will be approximately, because I'm ignoring these corrections, this ratio. Very good. So the work for you will be to compute the scaling dimension, the conformal, sorry, to compute the energies, to compute the momenta, to identify these 2 states, okay, so that you know what energies you have to subtract here and what this is as well, and then use that to compute the scaling dimensions. And I'm happy to go through this again when we start doing this. But do you have questions now? Very good. So what I've done is I've prepared the notebook. Does everybody have the notebook ready? I see lots of computers. Some of them are even open. Very promising.
And different.
Yeah.
What N do you use in your research if you write a paper? You're telling us don't go above 10. But if you want to make a 1 over N to manage, I mean, you would use 1,000 or something. That doesn't seem feasible. Hmm.
So we use N equal to 300. But I don't let you use N larger than 10. So there is a catch. And the catch is that the techniques that I'm telling you about here is the best you can do if you do exact diagonalization. Next week, we'll learn how to go from 10 to 20. And then time will be up. So we don't need to learn anything else. But what I was thinking is that the last class, I'll give you more of a talk, a research talk, on how we go beyond 20. And the key word there will be tensor networks. And so, you know, it goes well beyond what we can cover here, but it will be an introduction to what you could learn if you wanted to learn more. Okay? Is that good, Eric?
Thanks.
Okay, so we're done with the theory. And now what we need to do is to diagonalize matrices. Let's see. Do you all have the notebook ready? You know I'm a bit of a pain. I mean, I won't go on until everybody has the notebook ready. Yes?
I still can't download it.
Can Eric, would it be possible for you to email it?
Yeah, anybody else wants an email as well? Okay.
All right. So we'll be using this, and I'll go back to this later. But before I do that, let's go back to some purely computational considerations. So remember that if we have an L times L matrix, and this will be our Hamiltonian. So let M be L times L. We can ask how much memory it takes to store this matrix, and that's just the number of coefficients in the matrix, so the memory scales as L squared. Okay? And now you could ask questions such as, what's the cost or the time that goes into a matrix vector multiplication? So we take a matrix, we multiply it by a vector, and you know the memory scales as L squared because we have that the matrix is L times L. In here, what we have is we're multiplying the matrix, which again is L times L, times a vector which is size L. And how do we do this? We multiply row by row, right? So we could write it as m, let me just do it here directly, sum over m alpha beta v beta from, for beta from 1 to L. And the observation here is very simple. How many sums do we have? We have, how many times we have to sum things? So it's L times. And we have to do this for all values of alpha, which there are L values of alpha. So the cost of matrix vector multiplication scales as L squared. Okay, that's time. So vector matrix multiplication scales as L squared. Now, how about matrix-matrix multiplication? Well, let's see. We have these two matrices. It's L times L, L times L. And let's write it here. So maybe the final matrix is alpha gamma equal to sum over B. Alpha beta C beta gamma for beta from 1 to L. So if we multiply these two matrices, we have to do this sum that involves L terms. But this time we have to do it for all values of alpha, right? For each value of alpha and for each value of gamma, we have to do these L operations that are L values of alpha, L values of gamma. So you get L to the 3. Okay. So the time is L3 instead of L squared. Okay. And now remember that our L, for us, we have n spins. The Hamiltonian is a matrix that is 2 to the n, for n spins. And so that means that our L is 2 to the n, right? And that sounds pretty bad, because this means that our time scales as 2 to the 2n in matrix vector multiplications, and scales as 2 to the 3n, even worse, for matrix-matrix multiplication. Very good. So the first thing we want to do is to check all these statements, whether that's what happens in practice. It's back. Good. But the idea also is that in the end, when I talk about matrix-matrix multiplication, that's what it takes to diagonalize the Hamiltonian. It's the same as matrix-matrix. The cost scales in the same way. But today we'll see that if we only care about the low energy spectrum, that's what today is about, then we can get away with alternative algorithms that are based on matrix vector multiplication. And what that means is that the scaling will be 2 to the 2n instead of 2 to the 3n for those algorithms. And that will allow us to go a bit beyond, right? With the same time, we can consider larger n, larger spin chain. Okay? So the first exercise now is about doing this, checking all this. So if you have the notebook, we'll start. Today we'll be using pyplot, linear algebra, and RPAC. Oh, sorry?
What's RPAC?
It's a library, well, the package that you have to add. I could have told you this before, but then, yeah, no surprise. So can you please add RPAC? Yes. Okay, so see, yeah, please try to add RPAC. Now, there is nothing I need to say about this function. It's the one that we built last time on Friday. So it produces, it takes as an input the size of the number of spins in the spin chain, and it produces the Hamiltonian. There is also the angle theta there. Where else? And then, so here is a new function. So in here, what we're doing is we're building the Hamiltonian. And once we have the Hamiltonian for, say, eight sides, right? Eight sides. What we can do is we can follow what we did last time. We can use eigen. We can use eigen, right, to find the, to diagonalize it. But this is the bad guy. This is the guy that scales us 2 to the 3n. OK? It will take this time. Now, your new friend is another function, x. It's in RPAC. That's why you need package RPAC. And for this guy, you're going to give the same, as an input, the same Hamiltonian. And now, the number of eigenvalues or eigenvectors that you want to get out of it. And for us, this could be 1 if we just care about the ground state, or 2 if we want the ground state and the first excited state. And in this example, I got a 2. And finally, you want to say which, and then equal to SR. SR means small real part. The idea is, you need to define what you mean by the first excited state. In this case, we care about the bottom of the spectrum, so ground state energy and first excited state. That corresponds to the eigenvalues, the energies, with the smallest or most negative values. OK? So this small code, piece of code here tells you that we're going to diagonalize the Hamiltonian using eigen, and also using aix for just the ground state and the first excited state. And then we're going to look at, we're going to compare, we're going to make sure that the two functions give you the same answer for the ground state. So remember that D here. Is that big enough? Usually you say, oh, make it bigger. And today you didn't say that. Is that a bit better? Okay. So here what we have is B, remember, vector with the energies, and U is a matrix that contains all the eigenvectors. So what we're going to do is we're going to pick up the first eigenvector and call it psi 1. And this is supposedly the ground state of the Hamiltonian. And aix will give us also a vector of eigenvalues and a matrix with the eigenvectors. Of course, only 2 eigenvalues, because we only asked for 2, and only 2 eigenvectors. And the first one will be, again, first column. And we're going to call it psi 2. And what we're doing here is we're just looking at whether these two states are the same, okay, by just computing their overlap. And when we do that, we get that this is just a comparison of the energies, minus 8 and minus 8. Both methods gave you the same ground state energy. And the overlap between the two wave functions was 1. So that's really good. That means that we've obtained what we wanted. All right, so.
Yeah. What happened to the second one? Because in there was a lot of eigenvalues which are the same.
they are degenerate at the second level already?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Well, I have a lot of six.
You have a lot of six. Oh, this is only eight sides. Eight sides. Okay.
And I check with every.
Yeah, that's risky, right? Now I'm going to try and see what happens. Okay, so you are right.
But, yeah, the problem is I try with all possibilities for psi 1, so 2 to 8, and it never gives me 1. So
no,
I
because if you have degeneracy,
yeah,
you're making a choice within that set space. There is no reason why one of the choices would be equal to the other. Yeah. So that's fine. That good. So why did you trick me into changing the code? Okay. So for the ground state it works. And I don't accept questions. All right. So exercise, the first exercise for you is to check the scaling of the computational time within. And so the idea here is to really check whether two methods scale in a different way. And to do that, that shouldn't be in here. So your notebook says exact diagonalization 3 empty, and I'm using the complete version. So you probably don't have this in here. Maybe I should just look at what you have before I. Sorry?
It was complete.
I gave you the complete one?
Yeah.
And the name?
No.
The name was empty?
Yeah, the name was empty. But
okay. Oh, really? No. I hope I gave you this one. Really?
Yeah, here it is.
So, did you hack into my laptop?
No.
Okay. Good. Okay, so just to, you know, you learned last week that all you need to do in this class is to know how to copy paste. But today it's going to be way more difficult. So, right, so this is what you have. And if you use full diagonalization, so what we have here is for n equal to at most 10, so the spin chain will go from, I think it's 0 to 4. We're going to diagonalize the spin chain for a growing number of spins, starting with 4 spins all the way to 10 spins, right? 4, 5, 6. For each number of spins, we'll diagonalize and get the ground state. We'll diagonalize the whole spin chain that's happening here. Right, we build a Hamiltonian, we diagonalize it, and then we're just going to be counting how long this takes. Okay, we're going to store the time that it takes in time pool, and then we'll plot the time as a function of the system size. And I'm just going to do it right there. This is the result. Okay, so let me explain this. So the time so these are different times in logarithmic scale. This is the system size. We started at 4, 5, 6. The time, it was so fast that it just doesn't show. For 7 spins, I took some amount of time in terms of seconds on the order of 0.1 seconds. And as we increase the system size, this keeps increasing. And by the time we get to 10 spins, it already takes 1 second or so. Okay? So of course, we could have continued a little bit. But later I'll show you what happens if you go to 14 spins. We don't have time here to do that. So your exercise is to repeat this, or to complete this plot, by adding 2 more lines. One corresponding to number of eigen. So you want to be using 8. Okay, for NEV equal to 1, just to get the ground state, this would be second curve. And NEV equal to 8, that would be a third curve. And I can show you the results. It will look something like this, where we have the black one, the one that you already had, the yellow curve, and the blue curve. Blue curve is for one state only. We're trying to diagonalize NEV just one, and this is getting 8. Okay? So now it's your turn. So let me continue. You can try to finish this later. So the idea is that, forget about the red lines for a minute. The idea is that we have, everybody got whatever, right? But it's not very clear that one, it's clear that the full diagonalization, the black line on top, takes more time than the others, okay? But the scaling, is it to the 2n, to the 3n? That's not very clear from here. That's what the red lines are, actually. So this is the scaling, supposed asymptotic scaling of the black line. That's 2 to the 3n. And this other red line is 2 to the 2n. And the point of this exercise is that it doesn't matter what the theory tells you. The type of Hamiltonians that you are using are small enough that you don't see that scaling. It also happens that as you consider larger Hamiltonians, maybe your laptop uses more processors in parallel. You don't know what's going on. Thing is, you don't see the scaling. So I got really upset about that. And so I decided to try for larger system sizes. And then, luckily, at some point,
the screen just went off. And then nothing. You saw it for one. Oh, no, it's back.
It's so negative. So, you know, you're seeing this part here, and indeed the scaling is a mess. But if you continue this to larger system sizes, and this takes on the order, I think it was 100 seconds, so not, well, we should have it here.
1/10 of a second, if you could.
No. 10^2,
oh,
right?
Okay.
So you can see that indeed, these two schemes, which are aches as opposed to eigen, this ache suddenly scale more clearly as 2 to the 2n, which is this red line, whereas the full diagonalization is getting closer and closer to the 2 to the 3n. Okay? Questions? Okay, so now I think today we won't finish everything I wanted to do, but that's okay. Remember that our goal, so the point is that we're going to be using aches because we only care about low energy states today, okay? And you know why we're using those, it's cheaper. And if we do that directly on the Hamiltonian for n equal to 10 states, for instance, we have it here, we get the energies that we wanted. This is the ground state energy, first excited state, okay? These are energies as a function of eigen vectors, first one, second one, third one, fourth one. But here, we don't have information about who is the stress tensor. So remember that there are two states that we care about. This is the energy of the ground state. Now we need to find the other state that is always present in any CFT. That's the stress tensor. And to find that state, it's not enough to have energies. We need to find momenta. So we need to diagonalize both the Hamiltonian and the momentum operator, or the translation operator. And in the end, what I want to show you, you know, there is some plot, some information here. This is coming from the CFT side. These are the exact results, the ones that we would like to get a good approximation to. These are the scaling dimensions and conformal spins, organized also by parity, of the lowest energy states of the CFT. And this piece of code, all it's doing is just plotting them. So this is coming from the CFT. You see conformal spins versus the scaling dimension. We have the identity operator. It's always there. We have the energy density. We have that at momentum 2, or sorry, scaling dimension 2, there is a state that corresponds to the stress tensor, right? 2, 2. Remember, 0, 0 is always there. 0, 0 in any CFT, and the 2, 2. Okay, and the rest may depend on what phase transition we're studying. Okay, so the goal for today, the final goal for today, was to populate, to use for you to diagonalize the Hamiltonian together with the translation operator and find estimates for all these guys. So that's the exercise for today. Okay. So using 10 spins, you want to diagonalize the Hamiltonian and the translation operator, identify with the stress tensor state. Remember, it's the lowest energy state with moment, with conformal two. And use that to extract the scaling dimensions. Now, I think I will have to go through this on Friday again, because there is not enough time. But let me show you the type of answer that you would obtain at the end of the process. So for n equal to 10 spins, the blue dots, remember, the yellow squares are the exact solution. And the blue dots are the approximate solutions that you get for n equal to 10 spins. Okay? And you can see that it's a very, very good match. That's because this is a spin chain, which is very, very simple. Criticalizing model is the one that will give you very simple, nice results. Any realistic, more realistic spin chain at n equal to 10, so for 10 spins, you won't see anything. Okay? You'll have to go to much larger system sizes. But we're using a very simple spin chain so that we can illustrate the concept. Okay? So it's time to stop. What this exercise illustrates is that if they give you microscopic Hamiltonian that you know it corresponds to a quantum phase transition, you can just use exact diagonalization of the Hamiltonian and the translation operator to extract universal data that characterizes the phase transition. This data, knowing that there is a guy here with conformal spin 0 and scaling dimension 1, that tells you about the critical exponents of the theory. Okay? So this is a demonstration of what you can achieve just by diagonalizing the Hamiltonian. Okay. We have to stop now because of the colloquium. If you have questions, maybe Friday we can chat. All right, thank you.